once more into the breach, dear friend.
Now let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And I always forget what to say at this point.
We don't have to keep talking. We've said our names. It's all done.
Yeah, we said them together. Pretty good, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's true.
How many? 23 years of practicing?
One, two, three. I don't have enough fingers and toes. I'm not sure how many it's been.
Anyway, the Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of this riveting, meaning painful and hot, radio program. It's also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, which does not imply that the SEC approves of us.
No. In fact, I think they make a point of saying they approve of no one, but they will let their disapproval be known.
Yes, they will. And let's see. We advertise on this radio program. No, we don't. We don't advertise this radio program. We don't pay for this radio program.
There you go.
They don't pay us for the radio program. We do advertise for the radio program on KTEM. That's another required disclosure.
Yes.
Let's see. We provide information on this radio program that is educational, but we don't provide investment advice. Investment advice is stuff that you should take with your personal goals and individual objectives and risk tolerances and such and such like that. And there's something else. The information we provide on here has been obtained from sources we believe to be reliable.
Wait, you know, let's use the word.
Deem?
Yeah, we deem.
We deem reliable.
How often do you get to use the word deem?
Well, believe to be is so long, and deem is just a short four-letter word.
But it's a word nobody uses.
We deem reliable.
How do you deem it?
Well, we don't redeem it.
All right.
But we make no warranty as to its accuracy or completeness. And we have a telephone call already on the number that you need to call if you're going to call us, which is 254-773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Good morning. I just wanted to get this business out of the way so y'all can tend to more important business. This concerns the government. Okay. What I want to ask you is this. When the government finds themselves in debt and they owe billions of dollars and they have their means through the U.S. Treasury to make money, why don't they just make the money and pay their debt off? And if you can explain this to the people out here, you know, common country people, 22 IQ people, you know, just kind of, common sense logic so we can understand what you're going to say so we can everybody understand it. And that's just a question, sir. Just curiosity. You've got the means to make money, make and pay bills off. Leave it at that. Thank you.
Well, that was actually a pretty good question.
Yeah, it's a pretty great question.
And it really the answer actually starts pretty simply. The Treasury does not have the ability to make money. It can't create money. Yeah. And that's a really good thing because we tried that back in the beginning in the Continental Congress before we had a constitution.
And once again in 1836, we did it pretty thoroughly. There's something called the Federal Reserve Act, which is the fodder of many conspiracy theories. But if you actually read the act, which I encourage people to look up the stuff. Some of it is really hard to read, but most of it isn't. The idea behind the Federal Reserve Act is you need a group that's independent from the political structure that's only looking after the buying power of the currency. What does that have to do with paying off debts with money you make? Well, it's called devaluing the currency when you make extra money to pay off your debts, when you just print it. Because suddenly there's a lot more of it available. If we just go back to the most basic concept of economics, the very most basic, second most basic, supply and demand.
That's the second most basic?
Yeah, you actually have to have people first.
Oh, that's
right. Demographics are a little bit, you have to have babies before you can have supply or demand. That's kind of like if a tree falls in the forest and nobody's there. So it's that basic. I still believe that there's a sound, and I do believe that there are economies that exist outside of humans. I just don't study them. So, Supply and demand. If
oh boy, did you open up a can of worms for that one?
Yeah. So supply and demand is basic. In order to for the money that we use to have value, its supply has to be controlled. And there's a group that does that, that was created in the Federal Reserve Act. So it isn't the Treasury just making money anymore. The Federal Reserve can do it, but they have a mandate that says they're not allowed to create runaway inflation in the process. It hasn't stopped accidents from happening, but they didn't do it on purpose. Is that a pretty good answer so far?
So far, so good.
Okay. So we mentioned two other times, the Continental Congress and then in 1836, Andrew Jackson presided over that. He abolished the then equivalent of the Federal Reserve, the entity that was in charge of maintaining the supply and demand of our money.
It was so the Second Bank of the United States.
Right. The Second Bank of the United States was abolished under Andrew Jackson. He had to go through multiple Treasury secretaries before one would agree to do it. But one did it, and when it did, we had, following this, 1837, we had a massive economic collapse, runaway inflation. It caused the currency in the southern United States to be practically worthless. It became wallpaper. And that's a nice little piece of information there that we have done that in the past, and countries do it today. Greece wanted to do it in the whole Grexit thing. Before the Brexit, there was the Grexit.
Zimbabwe, Venezuela's currency is virtually right. Worthless now because they just printed a whole lot of it.
Right. Brazil is kind of famous for it long term. And that they just did it regularly every 5 years or so. Mexico hasn't done it for about a decade, but they do it about every decade. So there's this thing about the American currency being strong and that people rely on it. It's because if you have a stack of dollars in 10 years, you can assume that that stack of dollars is going to be worth something in 10 years because it's got controls on its quality. Where if you have a stack of pesos, you're flipping a coin to see whether or not, and it may be a peso coin, it may be a million peso coin if you're not careful, because that's happened in the past. I remember, I have cousins on the mom's side. My aunt and uncle were missionaries in Mexico, and they would come and visit, and they would brag about being millionaires. My cousins, my child age cousins would brag about being millionaires in pesos because you could have a very small amount of money and have over a million pesos. So that was devalued enough. And then they just changed it and they said, all right, now we're going to go back. Every million pesos will now be worth one peso and the peso will be worth the same as a million before. And so it's not good for the economy and it's not good long term for trade.
You know, you hear the comment, at least you read it in the papers if you read papers.
I don't the anymore. Independence, they're all electronic.
The independence of the Federal Reserve, and it's crucial, and it's in the Federal Reserve Act, that the Federal Reserve operates independently from Congress or the President. Yes, certain members of the Federal Reserve Board, the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee, are appointed by the President and confirmed by the Senate, but they are not to be influenced by the Congress or the President, because obviously every president and every Congress would love to have the ability to do just what you said, have unlimited money to spend, to buy votes, in effect, by putting in whatever they wanted to put in and not have any limitations. The way the system is set up, the Federal Reserve Act, by law, requires the Federal Reserve to maintain stability in the currency, maximum employment and reasonable interest rates, or moderate interest rates, I think it's official, the term that's used. And that was actually not in effect until the Federal Reserve Act was passed in 1913, but it was not till 1933 that second portion of it where the Federal Reserve Board got those targets.
Well, then Dodd-Frank added some more stuff to it. They're in a regulatory position and a much stronger role, and there's some other pieces in there.
The important thing is that the Federal Reserve is, in effect, the quality control on the currency. Now, they've got some other objectives, too, but their bottom line objective is to keep the United States currency stable so we can say sound is the dollar and mean it. And we pretty close to we came close to losing control of that in the late 70s and early 80s when we had double-digit inflation because, frankly, we had more money circulating than there were things to buy and the prices kept going up.
Yeah, and that's a kind of a nice area of conversation. There's a really good reason for that happening when it did. And it goes back to obviously supply and demand, but even at a more, at a deeper level, back to that demographic thing. Demographics are important. When you have a working population, you can make more than a country that doesn't have a working population. How's that for amazing? When you have factories that have not been bombed into nothingness and everybody else has factories that were bombed into nothingness, you can make more than everybody else. And after World War II, we were the last remaining industrialized power that really hadn't been smashed into
oblivion
by each other. So we had this this ability to, you know, we did the Marshall Plan. We used a lot of that extra wealth because of what we had to help pull Europe out of that and help build them up. But we had a couple of decades of relatively little competition. We were the ones that set the price and the standards for quality. And we had unions form during the middle of that because if you could just set your price and your quality and nobody could argue with it because you're basically the only people out there that are supplying anything, then you can set in price rises. You can set up the fact that if you've worked at a corporation for 2 years, you get a pay raise regardless of if you've improved your production. You just get a pay raise because you've been there. And that's the basis of this union concept. And to go back earlier than that, unions were necessary in that a lot of people weren't getting paid even when they did increase production. So we've got this back and forth. It slides back and forth. When we were the only people making the thing, we set our own prices so that even if nothing extra got made, you got a pay raise. And that's the recipe for inflation. It's really hard for the Federal Reserve to get ahead of that without really seriously getting ahead of it. And they did. So we have another caller on 773-1400. You are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Enjoy the show. You guys were talking about currency and everything. When I was in school, I took a finance course and they talked about the different kinds of money. And I think it was M1 through M5. I've slept since then. Can you refresh our memories of what the different kinds of M currencies are?
Sure, we can do that.
Yeah,
but the
before we go into the details, that used to be a tremendous focus at the Federal Reserve, and it isn't anymore. It's a minor issue. The issue is how liquid is the money. For instance, money that's in a certificate of deposit is less likely to be spent than money that's in a checking account. So they're giving different categories. And money that's in other words, money that's set aside that has less liquidity, people are less likely to draw on it, isn't moving around as fast and it isn't multiplying as fast. Money is like cockroaches. If you let them move around, they multiply.
Yeah.
And the issue is, money is multiplied by banks making loans and by people buying things.
Yeah. If you think about this just for a moment, M0, there's M0 through M4. M0 is like the coins and the paper money. M1 includes deposits. So deposits at banks that are, you know, they're in circulation. You're using them. But it's not in your pocket. And then you can go up to M2, which includes some shorter-term CDs. M3, it's basically, you get the idea as you go up the spectrum for how liquid it is. It all is pretty liquid. You could get to all of it in a short period of time. Some of it would cost you a little bit of money to get to. So that the higher number on the M just means it's high. It's slightly harder to get to, a little bit less liquid.
And back when Chairman Volcker was the chairman of the Federal Reserve, that was a big focus, and it was they really tried to focus on that. But lately, things have changed quite a lot because
in fact,
majority of the money that's out there right now, floating around doing whatever it's doing, is not even doing it in banks, so you can't put an M on it.
Right. This is how far we've gone along that path. The Federal Reserve has stopped reporting on M3 and above. So nobody, it's not even used anymore because there are so many places you can put your money that's not in a bank right now. Money market fund is a good example of that. Short-term bond positions that are very, very liquid, and sometimes money markets invest in short-term bond positions. These are positions that may not be quite as stable. They're not as safe as a FDIC-insured CD, but they're very stable. And it's harder to categorize all the different types of money supply now because there's more of them.
And there's another aspect to this that we addressed in the newsletter this week. There's this amazing conundrum. Historically, since World War II, since we've had the economy running the way it runs today, under basically the rules it runs under today, whenever we have had very, very low very, very low unemployment, we have seen inflation go up. It's called the Laffer curve. Not the Laffer curve. I'm sorry. What's it called? I've lost it.
I'm sorry. I was reading something else.
No, the curve that says the unemployment goes down, inflation goes up. Anyway.
You're putting me on the spot.
Yeah, and it just went out of my head. But anyway, there was this theory, and it held up really, really well for about 50 years, that low unemployment equals high inflation.
Phillips curve. I always think of the Phillips screwdriver in that thing.
The reason that occurred was because when unemployment got really, really low, there was a shortage of skilled workers, and business began to bid for the skilled workers and paying people more and more and more to do the same amount of work. And so what we saw under those circumstances was the wages going up. And I saw this in the 1970s, personally witnessed it going on, and in the 80s, this is where we got the inflation. Wages kept rising because there was a shortage of available workers. And since it was more money to spend on a fixed amount of goods and services, the prices of the goods and services started going up, which caused the unions and everybody to demand more wage raises. And this cycle got kicked in, and it took a recession to get us out of it.
Yeah,
this obviously is not applicable anymore because we have the lowest unemployment we have ever seen. We have wages only rising on average at 3.1% a year. And we have inflation running about 1.7 or 1.8% a year. Something very massive has changed.
I can talk about that a little bit because the behavior side of economics has addressed the Phillips curve.
Where did they send it to?
The North Pole. It's almost Christmas, and they decided that they didn't want inflation this year, so Santa can have it.
They addressed it and sent it to the North Pole?
Yeah, and if you doubt that Santa's getting all the inflation, just drive around to some of the Christmas decorations and tell me how many inflated Santas you find.
Mm.
Uh-huh. You thought I couldn't come up with a
solution. So that's where inflation went to.
So on the behavior side, what they're saying is that exactly what you said, something kicked off that vicious cycle of the wage negotiations, of we're going to play hardball on the hiree side. I need this much because my friend is getting this much in another job, that sort of thing. That's not been kicked off this time. In fact, when the unions went on strike, I mean, this is part of our unemployment report this time around, the union went on strike against General Motors. And General Motors dug their heels in. They didn't come back with the juicy, juicy contract that the unions wanted. They came back with a slightly improved contract. And if you think about that for just a minute, there's the other piece. We've got competition from the rest of the world now.
And yeah, that's probably the big thing.
We didn't in the 70s. Now we do. If GM raises the price of its car, to support the union wages, then the price increase there, then Toyota's going to clean their clocks. Well, they might not. They're probably digital clocks. So it's just like Windex.
Well, it's Windex, the Swiss so would wind up cleaning clocks.
Yeah, that's the idea here is during this process before the Phillips curve was saying, look at the unemployment rate in the United States, and that's going to gauge the inflation rate in the United States, when really we need to look at the unemployment rate for the world now. And if you look at the unemployment rate for the world now, you'll see that we've got lots of jobs still available out there, and we're using those jobs. Even during the trade war that's going on now, we're still hiring more people in call centers outside the United States because we don't have enough people here.
And if you want to see one of the major reasons that that's occurring, you can see it graphically, you can see it in pictures. Go back if you can in Google or wherever and find pictures of freighters from 30 or 40 years ago. And they look
like Star Wars?
No.
They look different.
The pictures of ocean-going
real freighters. Okay.
Ocean-going freighters, and you see that they look like a ship. They look like, you know, there's a bridge sticking up and there's low areas in between and high bow and and all the goods that were being shipped were down in the hold.
Yep.
Today, if you look for a freighter, what you see is this gigantic multicolored box of shipping, gigantic shipping containers that will go on trains or trucks, stacked up high as a bridge practically.
With about a quarter of the number of people on board and about five times the size.
So it's actually less expensive, and I know this sounds really strange. Let's say you had a business in New England and you're making something and you want to sell it in California. It's less expensive to ship it from China than it is from New England to California because of these gigantic freighters. And the other thing is, we have just kind of accepted it at this point. But when you go into the grocery store and you see the produce on the shelves in the middle of winter, you see fresh produce that only grows in the summertime, and you don't think about where it comes from. It not only
think
is
all those wonderful tomatoes
it,
we like
it,
to
it,
eat.
It is not only coming from South America and sometimes from Asia, it's coming by air freight. We're actually shipping on airlines. Not airlines, on air freighters, the flowers, the vegetables, so much of what we have actually gets sent over here via air freight because the cost of transportation has dropped so dramatically across the world that we have effectively become a single employment mass, so that employing somebody in China or employing somebody in the other side of the United States, China's cheaper because in China they have lower wages. And
now there is a long-term solution to that, because neither of us like to say let's hire somebody in China instead of saying hire somebody in the United States.
Well, I don't know. Yankees?
I don't know. Yankees, are you right? Yeah, those Northerners.
They're probably Democrats too.
So this concept of where do you hire people? Well, it's not like we're lacking for people with jobs here. So it's not like we're losing jobs by sending them out somewhere else.
We're fully employed.
But the long term is that AI and automation is going to take a lot of that extra slack. And we have another caller on 773-1400. Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I was listening to what y'all saying there concerning, you know, different items shipped from one place to another. You know, do they regulate some of those items, you know, as far as produce and different items that are edible that are in the grocery store? And when there is a contamination with something that they find out that has some kind of a, you know, that kills people. Well, who flips the bill for that? How do they investigate that? Where does the money come from? That's what I need to know.
Okay. Good questions.
Well, interestingly enough, most of the issues that we've had with that recently have been originated in the United States, not overseas.
So we have a series of different organizations at the governmental level that cover this. So you got the Agricultural Department. You got the Food and Drug Administration. Let's see. There's at least one more. This is my Rick Perry moment. It's the Energy Department. No, it's not the Energy Department.
Well, we do watch this, but we watch it in a funny way. There's some degree of inspections that comes in the United States, but it's just random. The big way we deal with it is sort of a free enterprise way of dealing with it. When somebody starts getting sick from something they're eating, that is what sets off the alarms. And
there's normal testing.
We follow it back up what we do require.
That's what the Border Patrol actually is, customs. And when they come in, customs is also inspecting produce.
But if you have like a bunch of cans of stuff coming in from someplace, you can't open all the cans. The thing is, we rely on the fact that when it shows up and it creates a problem, we start back up the chain. Now, what we do require when food comes into the United States is that we know where it came from. In other words, it has to be sourced from it has to have some type of regulatory sourcing. So we know, let's just say there's a bunch of, I don't know, something imported foodstuffs from someplace, wherever, from Mexico, let's just say.
Let's make up a country. Peoria, Valia. Yeah, something like that.
Wherever. So we have to know the company that imports it has to produce certificates that we know exactly where this food came from and is traceable back. We do that now, by the way, all the way down to the individual cow. If you notice that when people are raising cattle, they have ear tags and
they've had ear tags for a long time, but now they mean more.
The bottom line to it is we can trace a piece of meat pretty much back to the cow or steer that it came from today where we couldn't in the past because we had problems with, for example, something, mad cow disease.
Yeah.
We've got a pretty secure food chain, but it's the chain that's important rather than inspecting it as it comes in and testing it because you can get by that. We basically say, if you deliver bad food, we'll shut you down. And that causes the people at the other end to not deliver us bad food.
Yeah, so
they deliver each other bad food, particularly in China.
And the Agriculture Department has set that up for meat and fish. So there's still a lot of fish that we import from overseas. So catfish is a big one. And that's usually, if you're buying catfish, it's likely that it was farm raised in China.
What's the other one? The one that is the
tilapia?
Tilapia, yes.
Yeah, there's a lot of farm raised Chinese fish now. And
which used to be orange roughy or something like that.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It tastes good.
Anyway, yeah.
So the idea here is they're testing that as it comes in. They test samples though. So the Food and Drug Administration has the ingredients labeling on prepared food. Agriculture covers unprepared stuff, produce, frozen vegetables, frozen
dead fish.
Fish, that sort of stuff. And the Food and Drug Administration, anything that's been prepared. So they have ingredient label requirements, and they're supposed to as well do sampling. But really what it comes down to is if we have an E. coli outbreak or a salmonella outbreak, it's either going to be the FDA or the Agricultural Department that dips into that and tries to find where it came from. The CDC may be involved as well.
And so we really got a very, very good system, and it is probably the best in the world.
We took nastiness out of pork.
That is
amazing.
It is based on supply and demand. It's not based on the fact that we have a huge regulatory agency. The agencies that inspect food coming into the United States or moving around the United States have very few people in actually inspecting food. They just do random sampling.
But if you get one nasty sample,
right,
it can affect your brand name forever.
And it can put a company out of business very quickly, and they realize that. And the issue is, in the United States, we take action on it. In other places, there's a tendency to kind of cover it up and say, you guys clean up your act, and we'll just ignore this poisoning of so many people. And we don't do that in the United States. So it works really, really – our system works better, far better, in my opinion, than any other system in the world, including places where they have lots and lots of inspectors trying to check the food.
Right. It's supply and it's a market-based system. People don't want to have sick customers. If you get a sick customer, you may lose your entire business.
We probably ought to talk about what happened in the market.
Yeah, let's do that.
By the way, this is December 7th, 1949. No, 1941.
Yeah,
that's right.
That date that will live in infamy.
Today, by the way, is December 7th. It's 2019.
It is not actually.
And we 41. Have a tendency to forget what happened on December 7th, 1941, but it's a bad idea. We were suddenly attacked by Japan, ironically, as a result of tariffs that we'd been imposing. We were attacked in Pearl Harbor, and a lot of Americans died, and it was the Day of Infamy, and we should remember it, and we should honor those who've died and those who died in that great war.
You know, last year was the first year that the ceremony at Pearl Harbor only had one survivor, or had no survivors show up. There's only one this year. He was sick last year. There's only two other survivors that are alive. Two other survivors, period. That's redundant, isn't it?
And we're trying, you know, I noticed we cruised through November 22nd like it was not even a big day.
Yeah, that was the 22nd of the 11th month of the year. What's up with that? 11/22. I mean, it's a big deal.
It was a big deal for my generation because that's when John Kennedy was assassinated, and we swore we would never forget that date, but we just kind of cruised through it and didn't pay much attention to it. Anyway, the S&P 500 stock index rose this week 0.16%, which doesn't sound like much because it isn't much. It's basically noise when we look at statistics. What happened early in the week as it was cruising up and being optimistic, the president tweeted that it may be after the election before we get any kind of a deal with China, and the market dropped. The interest rates dropped on the 10-year treasury. And then later in the week, a couple of days later, both the Chinese and the American negotiating team said we're on track and we expect a deal. So the market went back up a little bit. And then at the end of the week, on Friday, we had an unusually good employment report, 266,000 new hires, which is considerably more than any of the estimates had, any of the official or unofficial estimates had suggested was going to happen. And the market recovered, basically. And so even though 0.16% is what it went up, it was effectively a flat market, but with a dip in the middle for the week. As I mentioned, the interest rates came up a little bit this week, not a whole lot. They were up to 1.844% on the 10-year note, 10-year treasury note.
We just had Saudi Arabia just announced in its OPEC Plus meeting. OPEC Plus is all the OPEC member nations and then their alliance members that are saying they'll move with OPEC. And Saudi Arabia said they're going to maintain their oil export cuts, and they're actually going to increase the cuts another 500,000 barrels a day, which caused the price of oil to go up very little and then come back down again.
Well, it actually went up a fair amount. It went up 1.69%. If it did that every week for a year, there'd be a heck of a rise in the price of oil to be back to where it was last year.
What that's going to do is probably keep the price up right around where it is right now so that the people, I mean, the fracking fields have been laying off. They're likely to pick back up again because Saudi Arabia is doing them a favor. I find that humorous.
And we do have market. We do have commercials we need to play.
Yes, we do. If you would like to call us, our phone number here is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back on the other side.
And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. You know, I stopped saying that in my radio voice at some point.
Welcome back to The Personal Wealth Coach.
Well, that's a little bit.
This is a 1920s radio show.
That's a little overdone. No. Welcome back to The Personal Wealth Coach, where Jeff and Jake McClure.
See, that sounds like a 1970s radio personality.
Well, that's the real radio personality.
What about Wolfman Jack? See, that I think may have been the real radio personality. It just hurts your voice to say it that way.
Yeah, I don't want to be Wolfman Jack. I mean, Wolfman Jack was cool, and if you don't know who Wolfman Jack is, you're not a boomer.
I knew it was just because I'm a history buff.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, where were you in 62?
I wasn't.
Oh, okay.
That's an easy answer. I'm not really sure. No memory of that.
You know,
there was no quid pro quo, though. I'm positive of that. 1962, I had no quid pro quo.
I don't know. We could argue about that. The big news in the economy this week was that the U.S. added 266,000 jobs in November, which is a bunch of jobs. It's a little bit misleading because at least 41,000 some odd of that 266,000 was just the GM strikers going back to work. Probably some more than that. It's probably closer to 50,000. So, but 200, let's just say 50,000 people were just people going back to work because of the end of the strike. Then it would still leave 216,000 new jobs, which is quite impressive. And it took the unemployment rate down to 3.5% again, which is the lowest unemployment rate we've had in 50 years. So that's really cool. It ties with the lowest unemployment rate we ever had, which was during the Vietnam War when the economy was running at full tilt, making things to get blown up in Vietnam and sending a lot of people into the army to go get blown up in Vietnam. So we have an unusual situation when it comes to high employment, low unemployment. There's some differences between then and now, but not a lot. The bottom line to it is we have an economy that's about 70% driven by consumer spending. And we have a lot of employed people in the that are spending a lot of consumer money to consume things. So our economy is cruising along very nicely. By the way, the last estimates that I've heard is that the fourth quarter gross domestic product currently is trending at about 1.5%. And it's come down from 3% plus at the beginning of the year. Probably the fourth quarter will be around 1.5, which means our growth rate is decelerating in the United States economy. It's still growth. But it's decelerating, and it's steadily decelerating, and there's a lot of cracks showing up in the system, which we can talk about.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I did want to talk about. This is something we've talked about, and basic common sense, and people ask us for that. I wish common sense were more common. If you have a small business and you wish to grow your business, how do you do it? It really doesn't matter what you're making, what you're doing. If you want to grow your business and make more, it typically includes hiring someone. It also typically includes increasing your square footage of wherever you are.
Now, wait a minute. We have a business.
Uh-huh.
And supposedly it has 3,800 square feet in it.
Uh-huh.
I have looked all through that building for a square
foot. There's not a single square foot anywhere. All of our feet have toes on them. They're all...
I think that that is a misleading and misguided statistic.
You're right. We should say cubed footage. Wait, no, that's even worse.
Well, if you hire more people, you get 2 feet per people in most cases.
Right. And you can give them square meals.
I don't know. They look round to me.
So this is the idea. If you're going to grow a small business, it's the same as growing the economy in some ways. If you cannot hire the people to grow your business, then your business isn't going to grow as fast. And that's where we are. We're at full employment.
And if you stop buying new equipment and stop building new building, your growth rate may cruise along at a higher rate for a while.
But at some point,
it's going to grind to a halt
At some point, you have to grow the logistics part. The physical aspects of what you're doing have to grow if you want the rest of the business to grow.
And in the United States economy today, we're running really, really low on people to hire.
Really, really low on people to build stuff.
And we see a declining rate of building new buildings for commercial use or any other use.
I don't know what's going on. I mean, the American worker needs to have three full-time jobs, and then we can keep growing.
Yeah, but there would have to be more buildings for them to have the extra two jobs.
Well, see, that's one of their jobs would be making the building.
But they're not.
Yeah, they're lazy. They're just lying around all night long, sleeping and stuff.
And if you want to grow business, you have to buy new equipment. And what we've seen is commercial enterprises across the board are buying less and less and less. Matter of fact, it's a steadily declining rate of purchase of new equipment, which means that in business, and this is the big number out there that's not, you can't find it in any single place easily unless you pay for some economic analysis or something. But business investment is shrinking.
Yeah.
And business investment is what produces future growth. And when business investment shrinks long enough and significantly enough, every economic theorist agrees, we eventually turn around and the rest of the economy starts backward. But right now...
And that's an important thing to do. That when, by the way, just starts backward means to recede. That's where the word recession is. The economy goes backwards a little bit. In order for us to grow again, we need to retool.
We should get a red hat that says MAGA, Make America Grow Again.
Well, I mean, it's growing. It's not like we're not growing, and that's an important piece here. We've got growth. At some point, the growth will recede. People will make a great effort at blaming someone for this. It will be whomever is in charge at the time will get the blame. It will also blame specific businesses. But the reality is that it's part of a maturing cycle. It's the whole thing. It's like blaming the New Orleans Katrina incident on the Corps of Engineers. Well, you could say, yes, they should have made better levees, and maybe they should have. But it was a Category 5 hurricane.
That hit a city that is below sea level.
Right. Yeah, they really could have had more quality, and it still would have failed. So when you're talking about blame for natural events, including the economy, I consider that to be natural events. Recessions will happen, and they'll happen because we pick up a bunch of bad habits from being successful. You get really successful, you get hubris, you say this is going to go on forever, you make decisions without regard to keeping reserves. And then the recession hits and people lose their jobs and they all say, all right, we're going to keep reserves forever next time. And they start up very carefully and they only hire the best people to fill the jobs instead of, you know, we just need more people. Get them in here. So it's part of the cycle. And it's not any individual keeping it going or slowing it down. Although there are individuals that do add and subtract to it, it's part of the whole. It'd be kind of like saying it was the butterfly waving its wings that caused Katrina. It may have started it, but there were lots of things that added to it along the way. And that is kind of the underlying factor here is we're in this mature portion of a growth cycle. We're in a mature bull market in the markets. We're in a mature growth cycle in the economy. Does that mean it's imminently going to fall down? No, but there's a lot of danger signs that we're seeing that say it might. There are ways of fixing those things. Just like here's a one I think you can hop on, though don't hop too hard. Our logistical system in the United States, the bridges, the dams, are from the 1960s. The majority of our major construction and waterways and bridges happened in the early 20th century through the 1960s with the last big boom where they put in dams on a lot of rivers and they did a lot of work planning for the future. We put the dams in so that we can have water for the growth in population that we need to have growth in the economy. All of that stuff is aging. That means we have to spend some money, just like business has to spend money on business growth. The government has to spend some money on logistical stuff for demographic growth. Otherwise, we could just assume that our population is going to get smaller in the future, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just a challenge. That's my thing on demographics and logistics and where we are in the growth cycle.
And there's another strong, and there's a lot of indicators out there, and they're beneath the surface. One of them is the percentage of S&P 500 companies posting year-over-year decline in earnings. In other words, they made less money this year than they made the previous year. You would think, and if you see that, your impression is if they're making less money in each succeeding year, that's generally a bad sign and probably ought to be seeing a decline in the S&P 500 instead of rise in the S&P 500. But there's two sides to the S&P 500 right now.
Right.
About 50 stocks in the S&P 500 are growing like weeds. And there's about 30% of the S&P 500, which is obviously a larger number, that has declining earnings. And the last time we saw that was in 2009, and the time before that was in 2000.
Or in 1999.
No, 2009 we saw it, and then before that we saw it in 2002.
Okay.
So that's an indication that there's something wrong in corporate America when companies are making lower and lower profits. Now, if you dig down deeply, and I did in other sources, there's a really good reason for that. Those companies import a lot of their whatever that they use to make things in the United States. And you'll notice that despite the forecast to the contrary, and we were wondering how this is going to work out, the tariffs have not caused a rise in retail prices. We don't see any significant inflation in retail prices. But the tariffs are very much there. We have a 15% tariff on some things, 25% tariff on other things. So who's paying for the tariff? And the answer, the Federal Reserve came out with a very nice article on this, is that the companies in the chain after it hits the United States are lowering their profit margins to absorb the tariffs. But there's only so long that they can do that and get away with it before they have to start laying people off.
There is two sides of this as well. This is when you're talking about consumer purchases. So if you're a reseller and you're buying from China, you're basically cutting your margin. And on the other areas of tariffs, like the steel and aluminum, this has been back and forth and back and forth. There has been significant building inflation. The cost of building a structure has gone up significantly since the trade war started. So if you're building a house, if you're building a metal building, if you're building anything that is a physical structure, it's more expensive today than it was before by a significant amount. But most people don't go around building buildings every day. So it's a one-time event for them. It doesn't feel like it's a greater expense because it's their one time. They got one quote. This is what it costs, and that's what they do with it. If you're in the business of building these things, you know what I'm talking about. Everything's more expensive. And the price has dropped back down from its peak of really, really expensive, but it's still more expensive. And we have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Good morning. This is Rayford Brown and Temple.
Hello, sir.
On the debt and why expansion is slow, American businesses are already leveraged $1 trillion, and the Federal Reserve has been pumping, I think yesterday they said, $4 billion into the market.
$107 billion.
Yes, $107 billion.
Which is more than four.
Okay, so that's a lot of money when you start figuring it up for 52 weeks or 365 days.
Absolutely.
And my theory is that the Dow is really a measure of inflation if the underlying values of the companies is not rising at the same amount. And since they're leveraged for $1 trillion, you got to subtract that from their value. And what we're really looking at is inflation in the Dow, the devaluation of the dollar and what you can purchase with it. So I think we're in a heap of trouble because the Federal Reserve is leveraged out and businesses are leveraged out.
Let me point something out. The Federal Reserve isn't leveraged out. What they're doing, the $107 billion they pumped in on Friday, was mostly in repos, which means they pump it in on Friday and they get it back on Monday. They are just increasing liquidity. At this point, the Federal Reserve is only minimally increasing
its balance sheet.
The balance sheet or the cash in the system right now.
Now, that doesn't address a real concern that you have there with the leverage that exists on corporate America. Corporate debt is obscene right now.
Yeah, corporate debt is at record highs by any way that you want to measure it. Now, the good news is it's at very, very low interest rates, which means that their total debt service is certainly not at a record high. The problem that comes out of that, and it is one of those things that economists are just kind of holding our breath on. If interest rates do go up at any point, there will be a very large number of what are referred to as zombie corporations that will fail. There are corporations, you know, there's some popular ones, you know, like WeWork and Uber. They make the headlines, but there's a lot of corporations out there that are surviving by rolling over their debt to lower interest rates. It's like there's, I think, I don't have any solid data on this, but I get the sense that there's a lot of people who are rolling over their credit cards and refinancing their houses every few years and taking some money out at lower interest rates.
And that's a danger, that's the same danger that led into the bigger dangers associated with the Great Recession.
It isn't a huge bubble at this point, but it's out there. And you've identified a problem in that American corporations are probably over-leveraged at this point. But that is generated by something. You can't just blame the corporations. Blame the people who are buying the bonds.
Yeah.
And, for instance, I keep seeing this over and over again. Insurance companies offering annuities you give us your money and we'll pay you some ridiculously high interest rate. How can they do that? They're doing that by buying bonds that have relatively high interest. They have a portfolio of bonds with relatively high interest rates. We used to call those junk bonds. Now they're called, some of them are called investment grade, and some of them are called high yield, and some, they shop around for a rater who will give them a high rating so that the insurance company can buy them and meet state regulatory requirements and then sell you a high interest rate annuity. This is the area where I see the big,
some problems,
a bubble and a crack in the system right now.
And the a key point that he had, and we've just got a few minutes left, but a key point he had is looking at the growth in the Dow. And did you have something you
need to
say?
No, 1 minute.
Oh, yeah. And that's simply, he's got a very good way of looking at this. Benjamin Graham wrote a nice book on that. I'd recommend looking it up. It's Value Investor. He's talking about the book value. The value should drop with the debt. If the debt's added, then you should drop it by that much, by that much. And it's the way Warren Buffett does it. So you should pat yourself on the back for coming up with that theory on your own. And we're about out of time for this hour. If you'd like to contact us off the air, the number locally is
254-947-1111.
You can reach that number toll free at 1-800-914-7526. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. And you can see our newsletter there, radio recordings. You can contact us.
You can see our radio recordings.
You can click on them. Yeah. Jeff at tpwc.com.